This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. Again, we will travel with Cy Montgomery, reading from her book, How to Be a Good Creature, a memoir in 13 Animals, illustrated by Rebecca Green. I'll be reading chapter 2. She's traveling to Australia. The chapter is called Bald Throat, Blackhead, and Knackered Leg. This is about emus. Alone with the wind and the dry, wintering scrub, I was squatting in a sea of thorny ground cover in the middle of the Australian outback. Then suddenly I knew somebody was there. I was 26, 5 years out of college, and literally half a world away from home, which most recently had been New Jersey, where I'd worked for 5 years as a science and environmental reporter for a daily newspaper. But now I was sampling small plants for a graduate student's botanical survey. The only sound, other than my knife cutting the stems, was the wind blowing through the low bushes and stunted eucalyptus trees called mallee, until something jerked my mind away from my work. I looked up to see three giant birds, each as tall as a man, strolling casually through the brown grass, not 15 feet away from me. They were emus, nearly 6 feet tall. Typically 75 pounds, these flightless birds stand beside the kangaroo on Australia's coat of arms as a symbol of this otherworldly continent at the bottom of the globe. Emus seem part bird, part mammal, with a little dinosaur thrown in. Shaggy, twin-shafted brown feathers hang from the rounded torso like hair. A long black neck periscopes up from the body, ending in a goose-like beak. The wings are mere stumps and stick out from the body like comical afterthoughts. But on their strong, backwards-bending legs, emus can run 40 miles an hour and sever fencing wire or break a neck with a single kick. At the sight of them, a shock leapt from the top of my head down my spine. I'd never been so close to this large a wild animal before, much less while alone on a foreign continent. I was not so much afraid as I was dazzled. I froze, caught by their grace and power and strangeness, as they lifted their long, scaly legs and folded their huge, dinosaurian toes, then set them down again, balletically dipping their necks into an S-shape as they picked at the grass. They walked past me and then over the ridge. Finally, their haystack-like bodies blended into the brown, rounded forms of the wintering bushes and were gone. After they left, I felt a shift in my psyche, but I had no idea that I had just caught the first glimpse of a life farther off the beaten path than I had ever imagined. I could not have known it then, but these strange, giant birds would grant me the destiny Molly had inspired, and they would repay me a millionfold for my first act of true bravery, leaving all that I loved behind. Almost everyone had thought I was crazy when I left the United States. My mother had been horrified, though my father assured her the move would get the travel bug out of my system. I'd quit my well-paying job, one I had parlayed from a cub reporter, covering 9 rural towns, to the beat I had hoped for while I was a college journalism student. Within a year of graduating from university, having triple majored in journalism, French, and psychology, I was covering science, environment, and medicine in a state with urgent environmental issues to investigate and more scientists and engineers per capita than any other in the nation. I often worked 14-hour days and weekends and was hungry for more. My work was rewarded with awards, raises, and freedom. Surrounded with talented editors, smart colleagues, and good friends, I lived in a little cabin in the woods with 5 ferrets, 2 lovebirds, and the man I loved, Howard Mansfield, a brilliant writer whom I'd met in college. I was happy. And then came a gift that changed my life. After I had worked 5 years at the Courier News, my father, now retired from the Army and ever my champion, gave me a plane ticket to Australia. I'd always wanted to visit. Sculpted by isolation, Australia's animals outpace the imagination. Instead of antelopes or deer trotting on 4 feet, kangaroos bounce about on 2, carrying babies in belly pockets. Echidnas, quill-covered mammals who lay eggs, lick up ants with whip-like ribbons of sticky tongue. Beaver-tailed, duck-billed platypuses defend themselves with poisoned spines at the ankles of their webbed feet. I wanted to do more than just see these animals. I wanted to study and, if possible, help the creatures from whom I was learning. I discovered an organization that paired paying laymen with scientific and conservation projects around the world. Earthwatch, a nonprofit based in Massachusetts, offered citizen science expeditions geared to a working person's schedule. Each lasted only a few weeks. I signed up for a project in the state of South Australia, assisting Dr. Pamela Parker, a conservation biologist at Chicago's Brookfield Zoo, with a study of the endangered southern hairy-nosed wombat at Brookfield Conservation Park, a 2-hour drive from the city of Adelaide. We seldom saw the wombats, looking rather like koalas, but living in holes instead of trees. The wombats were shy and spent much of their time in the extensive tunnels they dug in the rock-hard soil. We would see them at a distance, though, basking in the afternoon sunlight on their burrow mounds. Occasionally we caught them and measured them, but mostly we surveyed their habitat, mapped their burrows, and counted their desert dry squarish scats in an effort to estimate their numbers. But we did see kangaroos every day, and they never stopped astounding me. Every creature, plant or animal, in the study area opened a new world, from the fist-sized lycosid spider who often appeared inside my tent at night, to the twisted acacia trees that somehow survived in their dry red soil. At night, we cooked our food over eucalypt-scented campfires. We slept in tents pitched beneath scrubby outback trees. In the mornings, we watched sunrises streaked with flocks of gray and pink parrots. Here was a taste of the dream I had cherished as a child, living in the wild, discovering the animal's secrets. I worked so hard and so earnestly that at the end of the 2 weeks, as I faced my return to the United States and my job, Dr. Parker made me an offer. She couldn't hire me as a research assistant, and once I went home, she couldn't pay my airfare to come back to Australia. But if I wanted to conduct independent research on any of the animals living at Brookfield Conservation Park, she would let me stay at her camp and share her food. So I came home, only to quit my job and move to a tent in the outback. There was one big difference between my dream as a child of living in the wild woods and moving to the mallee scrub of Australia. In my childhood fantasies, I'd had my mentor with me to show me the way. But of course, Molly was long gone. She'd died peacefully as she slept in her red canopy bed when I was a junior in high school. Who now would lead me, a mere human, lonely, disoriented, and inexperienced, into the land of unknown animal powers? I had no idea what I would study, so I began by assisting other people with their work. For example, taking plant samples for the grad student I was helping the first day I saw the emus. There were usually only 6 researchers in camp at a time. Sometimes I helped another woman look for evidence of introduced foxes. One day, several of us were tearing down barbed wire fences left over from when the park had been a ranch. We were cannibalizing the fence posts to mark wombat warrens for Dr. Parker's study when I saw the 3 emus again. They arrived noiselessly at a corner of the park about 500 yards from us. They appeared to be picking at a low bird nest-like clot of mistletoe in a eucalyptus tree. Again, the shock stung the top of my head like a laser bolt. Pay attention. We approached them with cameras and binoculars, ducking behind bushes in an attempt to hide, advancing only when we imagined they weren't looking. But emus are always looking. The average bird's eyesight is many times better than humans. We were within 100 yards of them when one pulled himself up to his full height, black neck upstretched, and advanced straight toward us. At about 25 yards, the bold bird turned and ran. I noticed he also raised his tail and excreted a sizable watery mass. Thereafter, the three emus ignored us and strolled off over a ridge. I searched out the poop and found it was studded with green striated seeds, mistletoe seeds. There and then I knew what I would study. Are emus important dispersers of seeds? What species do they eat? Do emu droppings help seeds germinate better? I spent my days roaming the outback in search of emu pies. For me, they were as precious and potentially informative as the discarded fuel tanks from an alien spaceship. I'd gather them up, schlep them back to camp in bags, and try to identify the seeds I'd find. I'd then return half the seeds to the excrement from which they came and place the other half on a wet paper towel and see if one group grew better than the other. At the close of one particularly sunny day, I paused to sit and rest on a fallen log. I was watching meat ants crawl over my boots, feeling happy and free. Now I had a scientific purpose to my wanderings. When I looked up from the ants, I saw the emus again, grazing. I ducked behind a bush, hoping to be able to watch them longer, unseen, but they had already seen me. One began walking straight toward me. He came within 25 yards and ran straight across my line of vision and then stopped. The other two advanced and did the exact same thing. The three stood as if waiting. Was this a challenge, an invitation, a test? They must have wondered, was I dangerous? Would I chase them? If I did, how fast could I run? Trying to hide, I realized, was futile. I remembered that Jane Goodall, whose famous chimp studies chronicled in National Geographic made her one of my childhood heroines, had come to the same conclusion. She didn't try to steal glimpses of her study animals. Instead, she offered her presence humbly and openly until the chimps felt comfortable with her. So thereafter, I dressed in exactly the same clothes every day, my father's old green army jacket, blue jeans, red kerchief. I wanted to reassure the birds, it's only me, I'm harmless. I reckoned they could see me long before I could see them. After that day, I began to encounter them more often. Soon I could find them almost every day, and within a few weeks, I could follow them at 15 feet, close enough to see their eyes clearly, mahogany irises with pupils black as holes. Close enough to see the shafts of their feathers, close enough to see the veins on the leaves of the plants they ate. I could easily tell them apart. One had a long scar on his right leg. I named him Knackered Leg. Knackered is Australian slang I'd learned from a zookeeper. It means messed up and is more impolite than I realized. His injury might have been the reason he sat down most often of the three. Blackhead seemed to be the most forward emu of the group and took the lead most often. It was surely he who approached us straight on during my second meeting with them. Bald Throat had a whitish patch on his throat where the black feathers were sparse. He seemed skittish. When the wind would blow or a car would approach, he'd be the first to run. I referred to the three as he for no anatomical reason. There's no way humans can sex live emus until someone lays an egg. But I couldn't think of these marvelous individuals as its. I knew, though, that they were not quite adult because they lacked the turquoise neck patches that adorn the mature birds, and they were surely siblings, having left their father's care. The male incubates the greenish-black eggs and takes care of the up to 20 chicks who hatch only weeks or months earlier. Like me, they were just starting to explore their world. What do they do all day, I wondered. On one of our rare trips to Adelaide, I'd visited the university library. Nobody had published a scientific paper describing the behavior of a group of wild emus before. So while I continued the seed germination experiments, and yes, seeds did germinate more quickly after passing through an emu's gut, Chronicling the birds' daily lives became the new focus of my work. I developed a checklist of behaviors: walk, run, sit, graze, browse, groom, and so on. I took inventory of what each emu was doing at 30-second intervals for half an hour. Then I'd switch to a narrative description for the next half hour. Back and forth I'd go between methods, from the moment I found them each day until the moment they outpaced me and left, which they invariably did. I never tried to run after them. It would have been pointless, but I always hated to see them go. Even the most mundane of their activities held me riveted. Watching them sit was a major discovery. First, they drop to their knees. What looks like a bird's knee is more analogous to a person's ankle. Then, to my surprise, to their chests. I hadn't realized they had two different sitting positions. Watching them rise was equally surprising. To stand, they jerked forward, using neck and chest to propel them to a kneeling position, and then made a squatting leap to their feet. Seeing them drink was also unexpected, so much so that I hadn't included it as a behavior on the checklist. It was weeks before I saw them kneel to scoop up beakfuls from a puddle in the road after a rare outback rain. Many desert animals get all their moisture from their food and don't drink, and I hadn't expected to see it. Watching them preen was also revelatory and deeply satisfying. I love seeing them groom their stringy brown feathers. As their beaks combed roughly through the barbules of their feathers, it recalled for me sunny, sofa-bound afternoons with my grandmother brushing my hair. I imagined how good it felt for them. I found myself sharing their pleasure in this calming, intimate act. On gusty days when the wind would toss their feathers, they would dance, throwing their neck to the sky, splashing the air with their strong feet. I had the feeling that they did this for pure joy. They also had a sense of humor. One day I watched them approach the ranger's dog tied to a chain outside his house. The dog barked hysterically, but bold Blackhead, head and shoulders raised high, continued approaching the straining animal head on. Once Blackhead was within 20 feet, he raised his wing stumps forward, hurled his neck upward, and leapt into the air with both feet kicking, repeating the behavior for perhaps 40 seconds. Soon the other two joined him, and the dog went absolutely wild. The emus then raced off across the dog's line of vision for about 300 yards before sitting down abruptly to preen, as if to congratulate themselves on the success of their prank. I admired shy Bald Throat and injured Knackered Leg for their bravery and realized that their leader, Blackhead, must have given them great confidence to be able to tease a predator. The three were quite aware of themselves as a group. Whenever one would stray too far from the others, he would look up, assess the situation, and run or trot to close the distance between them to 25 yards or so. After a month, I could sometimes get within 5 feet of Blackhead and within 10 feet of the others. I, too, looked to Blackhead for guidance. If I could catch his eye with a glance, I'd try to assess whether he was happy with me following everyone or not. In a sense, I was asking his permission to follow, and yet in another way, by acknowledging him as the leader of the group, I made him my leader too. Sometimes he would look me directly in the eye and hold my gaze, though in dirty clothes, my uncombed hair matting like the fur on a stray dog. When bathed in the sight of this giant, alien, flightless bird, I felt beautiful for the first time in my life. At dusk, they always seemed more nervous. Any quick movement, the sight of a car in the distance, a hopping kangaroo, or a tent blowing away, once it was mine, would send them running. Knackered Leg, after all, had an injury, and an injured animal, even a strong one like an emu, must always be on guard. But it was Bald Throat who was always first to run, and once the other two took off after him, I could never hope to catch up. Each night as I huddled in my sleeping bag, I wondered where the emus slept, or did they merely rest? Did one stay awake as a sentry? Did they kneel or sit or stand, perhaps on one leg like cold chickadees at home? Did they tuck their black heads beneath their wing stumps? Some mornings I got up at 4 a.m. to see if I could find them sleeping. I never did. But one evening I followed them, and they did not run. It was nearly dark when they sat down, all facing the same direction, beneath four stunted eucalypt that formed a canopy under the orange and purple sky. I sat also, so happy to be with them. But as dark gathered around us, I realized I was taking no data. I turned on my flashlight to note the time, and they leapt to their feet and ran away. Day after blissful day, I followed them. I accumulated thousands of pages of data. I felt I was doing something useful for science. Eventually, I would crunch these numbers and figure out what percentage of time they spent strolling, grazing, browsing, grooming, something no one had ever done before. When I went on a fossil dig elsewhere that I'd committed to help with, I made sure I trained a volunteer to follow the emus and take data in my absence. She seemed competent and determined. But would she miss things? The dig was fascinating, but I was consumed with worry about the study and I left a day early. I returned to find my volunteer had filled more than 100 sheets of data and was following the emus just fine. I just glanced at the sheets before I left to find the emus myself. It was dusky, windy, and raining, and the birds were jittery, jogging, then running, as they often were in this weather. I broke my own rule and tried to run after them, but they disappeared into the darkening storm. As the rain turned to hail, I threw myself into a gajira bush and wept. It wasn't the data on these emus I wanted, I realized. I simply wanted to be with them. 6 months is a long time to work without pay. I had always planned after half a year to return to the States. I would soon pack up my tent and move to a carriage house that Howard had rented for us in a small New Hampshire town. 5 days before I was to leave the park, I found the emu sitting near a favored patch of wild mustard. Knackered leg looked up at my approach, and then the two other heads rose and turned to look at me. I think they were sitting because the wind was strong enough to knock them over. I lay on my belly to minimize its force as they snatched mouthfuls of wild mustard and groomed themselves. The wind died down, and by noon we were moving again, strolling together toward the spot where I had first seen them. We crossed the sea of spiky plants. We crossed the reserve's main track. A truck passed, but they didn't startle. I got within 3 feet of Blackhead and held his gaze. Then I looked to Baldthroat and Knackered Leg. Never before had I seen the three so calm. I thought, tonight? The night would be moonless. Would I finally get to see them sleep? Even at dusk, no one jogged. No one ran. We entered an area of thick bush I'd not visited before. In the darkening brush, I could see only Knackered Leg 5 feet away. His injury had healed impressively over the months we had known each other, but I always felt a special tenderness toward him. And his trust in letting me get so close in the dark meant a great deal to me. I could hear Baldthroat and Blackhead's footsteps pacing steadily. I couldn't see my data sheet or my watch. Even the stars were obscured by clouds. I heard the birds sit down, thump to their knees, thump to their chests. I could hear but not see what they were doing, the scuffle of shifting their great armored feet behind them, the purr of feathers being combed through their bills, and then silence. I no longer even cared about the data. What mattered was it was dark and safe, and we were together as they slept. The day before I left, I followed them from dawn to dark. As eager as I was to return to Howard, as much as I looked forward to seeing my ferrets and lovebirds and friends again, I was heartbroken at the thought of leaving the emus. I wished I could convey to them what they had given me, peace as soothing as the calm they feel when they groom their feathers, joy as spirited as their dance in the wind, satisfaction as fulfilling as a belly full of mistletoe. I learned a great deal in the outback, from how to conduct a behavioral study to how to urinate outdoors without peeing on my shoe. After living in the bush for 6 months, I knew I could never return to scrambling into pantyhose to work in an office or answering to a boss. Now I knew I would spend the rest of my life writing about animals, going wherever their stories would take me. Molly, who had saved my life, had shown me my destiny. The emus, on their tall, impossibly backwards-bending legs, had let me stroll with them for the first steps along the path. The data I'd amassed on the emus was new, but not particularly surprising. I didn't discover the birds using tools or waging war against other emu groups the way Jane Goodall found with her chimps. But in my last hours with the emus, I realized something that would prove to me as a writer very important. To begin to understand the life of any animal demands not only curiosity, not only skill, not only intellect. I saw that I would also need to summon the bond I had forged with Molly. I would need to open not only my mind, but also my heart. And that's the last part of the second chapter. Molly was the topic of her first chapter in this book. I'm reading Cy Montgomery's How to Be a Good Creature, a memoir in 13 animals. Molly's a wonderful story about a very little girl, Cy Montgomery, as a tiny child, yearning to be out and about with all kinds of restrictions on her life, as many little girls are restricted. Molly was a Scottish terrier and her guide to the real world. All of my programs are archived at wdrt.org under the podcasts. So next week, another adventure. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you so much for listening.